This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry, here with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Recording early today at 10 a.m. Pacific time here on March 17th. So if markets move, and as we like to say, Sam, they move every second, things may close and will likely close different from where we're marking things right now. We are we're in the middle of March Madness. It's the St. Patrick's Day, which is why we are recording early. Why don't we get into where are we at least for the week? It is a quad witching day today. Those of you that are interested in that, you can go back to episode number 36 that we did on October 8th of 2021. So we've been doing this for a while now. We did talk about witching hours back on that podcast, and it could lead to a lot of volatility here before the end of the day here. So 3 hours to go. What can happen?
Yeah, that's right, Jeff. So let's just jump right into it here with kind of this midday update on the markets here. So starting with the S&P 500 on a week-to-date basis, it's up about 1.5%, 2.5% for the year-to-date, so maintaining that positive that print so far this year. Leading the charge on the week so far, we have technology and comm services up both over, let's just call it about 5.5% on the week-to-date basis so far. And on the flip side, we have financials and energy both down about 6% on the week. So kind of the two bookends of the sector universe there underlying the S&P 500, kind of reflecting that technology and growth win for the week is the Russell 1000, the tech and the comm services win on the week. We've got the Russell 1000 growth trouncing the value component or the value counterpart there. Growth is up 4%, whereas the value, Russell 1000 value is down. Moving over to fixed income land, looks like bonds got a good start this week as well. The 2-year treasury note is down a whopping 65 basis points so far this week. It puts the yield in just at about 3.95%. So it's interesting. Haven't seen that below 4% in some time here. So I think it just broke through this week as we had the close last week at 4.6 yield on the 2-year treasury. Going down to the 10-year part of the curve, we have a yield at 3.4%, down 30 basis points from the previous week. And on the bond, it's 3.6% yield. And then for the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate, that's up 1.5%, kind of in line with the S&P 500 as I look at it across the board here right now. All the constituents underlying the A were the leaders this week within the sectors that we look at here in the fixed income universe. Leading the way is agency mortgage-backed securities, up 2%, U.S. Treasuries up 1.5%, and IG corporates up about 1.25% for the week. On the flip side, we have the credit sectors. We have, some of the non-eggs, the non-traditional sectors, let's call them, with bank loans down almost 2% on the week, and EM, sovereign debt there, is down about 0.5% so far. High yield corporate, I guess at this point, we can just call it about flat. I'm seeing down 5 basis points at the time of recording. Not everything was green in the land of financial markets, however. Looking at the Bloomberg Commodity Index, that was down 1.7% so far. leading kind of the charge here. I mean, it's not the worst performer, but it's a pretty, actually it is. I'm sorry, I take that back. It is the worst performer within the commodity, the broader commodity complex that we look at for the components that underlie the Bloomberg Commodity Index there. WTI crude oil is down about 12.5%. It is now trading at a $67 per barrel of WTI crude oil. So it's dropped below that 70 kind of resistance point that you and I have been talking about for a while there, Jeff, for WTI crude oil. So it's a weak thing to see that happen this week. A lot of that was on the back of the macro uncertainty based on the events that we highlighted in last week's episode, among a few other things that happened in the macro markets that we can talk about later on. Also looking at gold, gold went the other way around, bro, up 5.5% to close, or to the point where right now we're trading at about $1,968 a troy ounce of gold. So back above that 1900 mark there with gold. It'd be interesting to see if it's able to stay and maintain at that 1900 mark. But kind of given what we just talked about there on the WTI crude oil and macro uncertainties, I wouldn't be surprised to see it stay above this 1900 range. And then finally, to round this all out, Bitcoin up a whopping 30% this week. It's now at just under $27,000 a coin here for Bitcoin. So with that wrap up of the market, Jeff, do you want to let listeners know what happened on the macro front this past week?
Yeah, I think it was interesting, Sam, as you're going through the markets, it seems like there's a disconnect and you have, you know, rates up or rates down a lot. As you said, 2 year down 64 basis points on the week, you know, month to date down 80, ags up. Given that rate move, you have, you know, commodities down or, you know, oil down a lot, kind of on growth concerns, gold up a lot on, you know, kind of that flight to quality. So given that backdrop out of all those kind of different components that we're talking about, you wouldn't expect that stocks would be up. And certainly financials down significantly, energy down kind of following that gold or the oil move. But stocks overall, you know, S&P up on the week. And, you know, I looked to see whether it was just, you know, the week to week bailout to bailout type move and whether it was up there. But if you even if you take it back to March 9th, and say March 9th through right now, it's still up. So a little bit of a disconnect there. You know, people always say that is it the bond guys are right or the stock guys are right, and so it'll be interesting to see over time who is correct.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a little bit of I guess it's not euphoria, but people are breathing a sigh of relief and probably thinking that they're looking and seeing that the Fed is stepping back in. You've got the FDIC. I looked at the bank failure list, you know, the bailout list, let's call it, you know, from what came out with the BTFP funding program recently. But there's two banks that have now been declared as failures by the FDIC. You know, we talked about last week, Silicon Valley Bank, and that happened on March 10th. And then on 2 days later, on March 12th, we had the failure of Signature Bank as well. So, you know, seeing the Fed step in the way they did, the administration via the Treasury step in the way they did, and of course the FDIC fulfilling its role this time above and beyond the 250,000 insured depositors. So I guess there aren't those higher views that you and I have been talking about, perhaps in the last episode. So I guess, you know, maybe a little bit of a euphoria, you know, based on that.
Yeah, and I guess usually the answer usually is the case lies somewhere in the middle between the bond guys and the stock guys.
That's right.
But yeah, we'll see. Over, you know, luckily we're not trying to buy. You know, we're investing for the long term.
That's right.
If we move over to as you said, let's move on to the macro side of things. Does anyone remember when we had inflation and we were all worried about the Fed and inflation? Well, we did get the CPI this week. The month-over-month numbers for February came out as expected. Kind of the print was 0.4%, and 0.4% was the estimate. The core CPI, so ex-food energy, came in at slightly above expectations at 0.5 versus the 0.4 expectations. That brought the year-over-year numbers headline CPI to 6 and headline or core CPI year-over-year to 5.5. You know, looking at it, the core services is the highest print since September. since September of last year. Goods are back to negative, slightly negative. So really looking at it, inflation is still high. I think that if we didn't have this banking crisis over the past week, we would be just debating and people would be settling on the fact that the Fed would probably be raising 50 basis points here next week, just given that these inflation numbers are too high still and they need to bring them down. Wednesday, we did get the PPI. That number came in, those numbers came in a negative 0.1 month over month for February. That was well below expectations of a positive 0.3. Ex-food and energy came in flat, below the 0.4 expectations. That brought the year-over-year PPI final demand number to 4.6 versus a 5.4 expectations. And that brought the ex-food and energy to 4.4 below the 5.2 expectations. So you look at that, though, and you think, okay, maybe you know, as we've talked about in the past, Sam, the PPI sometimes leads, sometimes doesn't. Can't really draw too much out of that, but put the CPI and the PPI together, still inflation is still too high for the Fed. And the Fed would likely continue to raise rates. And we'll talk about kind of what the market's expecting here in a second. We also got on Wednesday the retail sales numbers. The advanced number month over month came in right on expectations, down 0.4%. There was a very strong January number. So this was just a little bit of a pullback there from that retail sales. The ex autos and gas was flat, a little bit stronger than expectations. It was expected to fall by 20 basis points. And the so-called control group was up 0.5% versus a negative 0.3% drop. So the control group was actually stronger than expectations. Looking back at the Thursday, we did get the jobless claims numbers, as is typical. Steady as she drifts there, back below 200,000 for initial claims, back below 1.7 million for continuing claims. So that kind of aberration we did see last week from, people were blaming California and the weather we had here in California as kind of that rise there, that give it all back, right? That's on the good side of things. Then we got the today we got the leading index. That number came out right at expectations at negative 0.3. That brought the year-over-year to down. It was negative 5.9, now negative 6.5. So back below that kind of that six level that kind of is indicative of a we get below that six level, we always get the recession versus that kind of zero level, which we look at does have some false positives. And then also this morning, we got the University of Michigan 5 to 10 year inflation expectations, the number that Powell pointed at when he wanted to raise rates. So he won't be pointing at it again next week because that number came in at 2.8%, 10 basis points below the 2.9 estimate. So that kind of wraps up the macro side of things. From a Fed speak, there was no Fed speak because we're in the blackout period. We do have the Fed meeting on the 22nd, or the press conference and the rate decision on the 22nd. So on Wednesday, checked Nick Timiraos's Twitter. Nothing too much, nothing important from there. Looking at the Fed rate expectations, we have a 70% chance or 70% probability of a 25 basis point rate hike next week. It was pretty low earlier in the week. I think people were expecting the banking crisis to cause the Fed to pause. I think the market has taken in the CPI numbers. The fact that S&P's up, so the market or the equity market overall is not projecting a calamity, at least over the short term. So it makes sense for the Fed or for them to price in the Fed raising 25 basis points. Let's keep an eye on Twitter and Nick Timiraos's Twitter here over the weekend, because remember last time it was a Monday tweet that kind of shifted Fed rate expectations. We did get the balance sheet numbers from the Fed came out yesterday. It looks like there was about $148 billion in discount window borrowing, $12 billion in the new bank term funding program. That's the new funding program, the BTFP, that Sam that you mentioned earlier. It's so hard not to call it the BTFD, but the BTFP, and $143 billion in borrowing for banks seized by the FDIC. Normally, I was reading Jim Bianco's research this morning, and he's like, normally you don't see that number because most of the time, at least historically, when there's a bank failure, another bank takes it over. But because no one wanted to take over, or the bids were not acceptable for the Silicon Valley Bank, that's why this number, $143 billion, is from the FDIC insurance there. You know, the balance sheet is a huge unwind of the balance sheet. You know, whether the quantitative tightening that has occurred, you know, it's about 4 months worth of quantitative tightening unwound in a week. That question is this QE? And this is something that, you know, we were debating on our trading desk, you know, 20 minutes ago, I guess 30 minutes ago or so. You know, certainly that, you know, we can all agree that having bonds that are worth 80 cents on the dollar, getting, you know, kind of putting them as collateral, getting 100 cents on the dollar back, that's like a negative haircut there. That creates money for the banks, but is it really? I guess the real question is, are we going to get, doesn't seem like that's going to be very inflationary unless the banks take that and start making loans. Right now, certainly seems like the banks are in survivor mode. They don't want to be making loans, don't want to be taking on risk. You know, you kind of seen that with some of the, you know, the fact that there's a consortium of, I believe, 11 banks that put together $30 billion of deposits that, you know, mostly it's deposits that they've received in all of this turmoil and put it into First Republic Bank as a deposit. And that's supposed to last at least 120 days there. So, you know, if your banks are really interested in making loans, that would be the money that they would be able to use to make loans. So it doesn't seem like they're really in the business, at least over the short term here, of taking on risk and making loans. So that's going to be some pretty good, tightening in financial conditions. Just the fact that they're not making loans, and that's really what the Fed wants, you know, to get inflation under control. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how this works itself out. The BTFP at only $12 billion, I would expect that number to increase pretty substantially as the banks get a little bit more comfortable with the program. 1 week of a new program, really, you know, I would have expected that number to be pretty low, and it was. And then finally, let's just wrap up all the banking crises, at least so far. You know, we did get Credit Suisse, got a lifeline from the Swiss National Bank, getting a $50 billion lending facility that they can tap if needed. And it really seems like there's that kind of, you know, bailout, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, of Credit Suisse there. And, you know, I guess that's kind of also contributing to the euphoria, Sam, that you mentioned.
Yeah, and I think you're right calling that a bailout, you know, so otherwise, who knows where CS would be right now, or, you know, in the coming weeks. But, you know, thanks for that that macro backdrop there. It's definitely a lot of information for us to stay on top of there. But let's kick it off into the topic of the week. This week, we decided to take another look at the yield curve and its usefulness as a recession indicator. But this time, you know, we wanted to focus a little bit more on the timing aspect, you know, how these curve inversions and shifts in the curve might serve as an indicator of when we could expect a recession to occur. So for those who are less familiar with the yield curve and the implications there, I would suggest listeners to look up episodes, 11, 52, 59, and 97. And in that order, it's one of those things where it's reverse order, but I would take them there because Jeff and I like to build on topics over a series of episodes. So 11 really is kind of the fundamental building block. And then from there, we add to it in our discussion and conversations around the yield curve. And if you're interested in other recessionary indicators that we at Double Line find interesting, then you can hit up episode 98, which is really just an update to the data that we first provide in episode 82. Again, that's on the recessionary indicators. But today we're going to focus and revisit the spread between the 10-year yield for the 10-year Treasury yield, to be specific, relative to the three-month T-bill yield, as well as relative to the two-year yield. So in some of these previous episodes, Jeff and I had noted that when we look back and take the data back to the late 70s, that encompasses six recessions. And with each of those six recessions, both of those yield curves, both of those spread between the, let's call it the three-month 10-year and the two-year 10-year parts of the curve, they inverted prior to the start of recession. And, you know, those recessions at least as they're declared by the NBER, which is the book of record on economic. So we've noted in these past episodes that while the inversion of these yield curves as a signal is a good indicator of an incoming recession, the amount of time between the point of inversion to the beginning of recession can be quite long, anywhere from 6 to 23 months before the recession. Again, using these two curves, comparing them to the last six recessions, 6 to 23 months prior from the inversion. So on average, the 3 month 10-year has a 13-month lead time, a little bit better than the 2s-10s, which has an average lead time of 15 months. So given this long lead between inversion of the curve and recession, we decided to look at how other shifts within the yield curve could work as signs on the road to recession. So for this, we looked at the point first. We looked at this point where the spread on these curves inflect from a, let's say, a more inverted state to a less inverted one. I'll frame this as point in the cycle where the spread reaches its most negative point. So, I mean, as you think through it, you'd be pretty challenged to accurately call an inflection point in the yield curve unless you have the benefit of good hindsight. But, you know, if I were to guess on the inflection point in this period, we may have already hit it on the 2s-10s this year. When I'm looking at it here, when I'm looking at it here on the 2s-10s, we have it down as the most negative in this cycle so far as -1.08, and that occurred on March 8th, so last Wednesday. And
what happened on Thursday?
Yeah, and then it's a big reversal, and then we've had this really fast jump to where we are today at, you know, negative, call it 50 basis points and some change here. So, you know, pretty big reversal. So for us, I mean, that feels like an inflection point on the 2s-10s. When we look at the, you know, the 3 month 10-year, it's still kind of down below 1% on the negative spread. You know, it got pretty deep there, but right now we're standing at about 107 on that spread there between the 3 month and the 10-year. But the max that got on the 3 month 10-year was down -1.27% on January of this year. So it hasn't moved that much. So I think with the 3s-10s, we may, you know, we could see a lower point on the 3s-10s, but the 2s-10s, it feels like we're there. So using this kind of idea of the inflection point as the basis, looking at the last five recessions that we have, the low point in the curve was made prior to the start of the recession. And the lead time for both of these spreads decreased by 6 months versus using the inversion as the signal. So inflection is improved on this timing signal relative to the inversion by half a year. And that what that meant is it put the average lead time to 7 months on the 3 month 10-year look, and down to 9 months if you one were to look at the 2s-10s there. I'll note that in the 1980 recession, which was the earliest recession in our kind of look back period, both curves hit their inflection point 40 to 50 days after the recession began. So I guess you can call it leading indicator for the most recent five recessions, and then the earliest recession acted as slinches indicators. And then finally, so in addition to adding this inflection point signal to our toolkit here, we looked at the point where spreads turned positive to use as a signal point. So when the curve uninverts, this was a bit tricky as there are a number of head fakes between when the curve inverts and uninverts. I don't know if you have that word, uninverts. Hopefully the listeners get what I'm saying here, but I guess said another way, you know, there's been a few recessions where spread on these curves, points in the curve, they go back and forth between being negative to positive several times prior to the beginning of recession. So there's a lot of noise in there. So to help us frame this and to categorize this kind of notion of going positive as a signal, we defined it as the final move from a negative spread to a positive one prior to the end of a recession. But you know, after this, the inflection point, after that inflection point was reached, how those things are going. Prior to the end of the recession, but after the inflection point that I just talked about earlier has been reached. So the point between those are as the book gets there. So both spreads here, again, the 3-month bill relative to the 10 and the 2-year relative to the 10-year yield, both of those went positive 2 to 3 months prior to the start of an accompanying recession. This 2 to 3 months kind of lead time was for the last 5 recessions when you're looking at the 3-month spread, and the last 4 recessions with using the 2-year. Now, when we look at the 1980 and 1981 recessions, the earliest 2 within our look back time frame, both the 3-month 10-year and the 2 stands went positive 3 months after the beginning of the 1980 recession, and the 2s triggered their indicator going into positive 3 months into the 1981 recession there. So again, that's, I guess, classified as coincidence, but using all this kind of as a framework to think about when, you know, the potential for a recession could come into play, you know, using those as a gauge and looking at it based on the current inversion point, we could see a recession somewhere in the fourth quarter of this year, 2023. If I were to use that average kind of lead time based on the point of inversion, if we were to take the low spread in the current cycle, so that deepest negative part of the yield curve inversion at the inflection point, then we could see a recession in the fourth quarter of 2023. If we were to use 2s/10s as an indicator, again, we think that one might have been breached there. But if you're to use 3-month 10-year and assume that that down 127 was the inflection point, then you can see a recession earlier. It looks like it would be somewhere in the third quarter of this year, using again that 3-month 10-year, assuming that we hit that inflection point already. Unfortunately, we haven't, or fortunately or unfortunately, we haven't got positive yet on these spreads, so there's no guesstimate if that is an indicator. But based on what, you know, we saw from the work that we did here, Jeff, it just looks like, I mean, second half of this year looks like a pretty good time frame, based using the averages of some of these signals that we talked about. But it looks like it's more likely going to be, if you want to hone in on it, if you can, in the fourth quarter of this year, based on the, again, the inversion, the inflection, and when it goes positive.
And I think that makes sense. That's pretty consistent with what we've been talking about, Sam, that you know, we're kind of at an inflection point. And you know, I think we're at even more of an inflection point now where, you know, keep an eye on that 2s/10s curve, that 3-month 10-year curve, see whether it starts to, get more inverted. If that spread continues to become more inverted, more negative, then maybe that pushes out the recession worries out further. But if we continue to steepen, then that would be much more indicative of a recession coming sooner.
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, it is one of these things that, like you said, it doesn't make some sense there, but it was nice just to put kind of, pen to paper, kind of old school here, but, fingers to the keyboard and seeing these numbers kind of play out like this. But again, it's, trying to get a sense of when the recession comes, and, it could serve as a useful indicator from that measure. But again, we're just using averages here. But either way, moving to the inflection point and then ultimately to the positive point and the curves does seem to shorten the window. So these are kind of road signs of the way the recession works.
It just reminds me of something that Mr. Gundlach said it's probably been 18 years or so now, where we were talking about what was going on in markets. And he said, you can keep dancing, but just start dancing closer to the door.
Yeah. It's the keep one hand on that exit door, right?
All right. With that, let's get to the things to keep an eye on for next week. The things we know to keep an eye on next week, because who knows what might pop up here before the end of the day today and next week. On Wednesday, we do get the FOMC rate decision. As I mentioned, there's a 70% probability of a 25 basis point rate hike there. Thursday, we get the jobless claims data. As usual, those numbers are expected to remain relatively flat. And then on Friday, to end the very light macro week, we do get the S&P Global Manufacturing and Services preliminary March numbers. Those numbers are expected to, the manufacturing is expected to drop slightly from 47.3 to 47 flat. And the services number is expected to go from 50.6 to 50.2. So still expansionary there from the services number, slightly contractionary there from the manufacturing number. So those are, should be a quiet week from a macro standpoint.
Yeah, it's something to kind of look forward to, but that FOMC is going to perhaps not be too much of a quiet week there.
Yeah, it never is.
Yeah. So get the popcorn ready, folks, and as we all become a, you know, industry of Fed watchers here.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, normally the questions that Chair Powell gets are, you know, pretty run of the mill. He can kind of guess what they would be. I think he's going to be in for some hard questioning, and it'll be interesting to see his answers and his demeanor. He's probably not going to be as relaxed as he was last meeting.
Yeah, but perhaps more relaxed than he was when he was testifying in front of Congress and the week before.
So. Certainly more relaxed than he was last week.
Yeah, hopefully the questions will be better, though.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, I guess that wraps it up. Nice, quick half an hour show here today. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in live and for the people listening to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks everyone for catching the Monday Morning Minutes here. Please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We should be available on all your favorite platforms by now. But if we aren't, you can hit us up on email at minutes@doubleline.com or on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Our website is doubleline.com. YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. You can see Jeffrey Gundlach on CNBC talking about the banking crisis. And it was pretty funny to see the host's reaction when he said that he thinks the Fed's going to raise 25. You can watch the latest episode of The Sherman Show with Katie Stockton on technical analysis there on the YouTube channel. Sam and Jeff's Twitter handle there. You can just click on it if you're doing the spaces. Otherwise, it's Sherman Show Pod. And those of you listening live, tune in to Jeff Sherman being on Bloomberg TV here in the 11 o'clock hour. So it'll always be interesting to hear what he has to say. So I guess that wraps it up, and hope everyone has a great week.
Yeah, thanks everyone for tuning in on St. Patrick's Day, and good luck out there.
The following presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.